The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. I think of this as the Empowerment Hour, because I can promise you there's going to be insights, information that will allow you to make better choices in your life. We like to take on all the issues here, starting with the latest on health and healing. I will address this big news story today about diet sodas making you fatter. I'll explain why and what they missed in this. Then my guest in the second part of our program will be Professor Jeff Madrick, and he is a professor at Cooper Union and senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. And we're going to talk about America's Age of Greed and how we got there. I'll be doing a commentary from Robert Perry, Common Dreams, on how greed destroys America, and then I'll be asking you to share your points of view just prior to my guest. Also, time permitting, vaccines as cluster bombs, from Rowan Contreba of World Press. What they don't tell you about vaccines that you should know, with some exclusive insights. Some coming attractions. We are trying to see if we can film the person who is actually behind the idea of the vaporization of material at 9/11. I've asked for a demonstration and film it, put it up as we're talking about it and having this person on as a guest. People can actually can see this. We're working on that as we speak. New information on HAARP, new information on contrails, but the way we always do things here, we have to make sure that we have good science backing up what we present on the air, so the process of verification frequently takes a little longer than normal. Also, for those of you who have never thought there was a legitimacy in what was considered the rabid rantings of extremists saying the bankers were behind the crisis and the Rockefellers, we took a very careful, scholarly, and methodical look over the past 9 months. New information clearly shows that these people had a lot more right than they had wrong. On my next Monday evening commentary, even though it's a holiday, I will be doing, you can download it whenever you want after that, I'll be doing a special one-hour presentation on who's behind the Bilderbergs, the Council on Foreign Relations, and the actual historically accurate connections to the families and individuals, people you didn't know, controlled the Federal Reserve, who also set on board of directors of major multinational corporations. I'll show you the web of who these people are, how they function, and what their impact has been. So we have a lot coming your way. Let's begin. This is from today's paper, from Bill Sanderson, and it says the following. Maybe next they'll conclude that water makes you fat. Diet soda, which has nearly no nutritional value, dangerously bloats waistlines and might boost blood sugar levels, according to new studies. People who drink diet soda experience a 70% greater increase in waist circumference over a decade than non-users, according to University of Texas Medical School. Quote, the more diet sodas people drank, the more their waist grew. Now, what they don't say in here is they've made two basic assumptions, neither of which is correct. They assume because there's no calories that you can't put weight on, and therefore they're unaware of why this happened. It's just a phenomena. And then the idea is, gee whiz, now are we going to ban something? This goes against this whole idea that we should have the freedom to choose. If you want trans fats in your food, you should have the right to that. If you want to smoke cigarettes, you should have the right to that. Now, I believe in freedom of choice, but I also believe in freedom of information. What if the FDA and the U.S. Public Health Service and the Surgeon General had come forward in the 1920s and said, all right, we have patent information that shows that when you smoke cigarettes, there are chemicals added to that blend in the cigarette that can cause addictions, cravings, beyond normal control. So understand that the intent of smoking a cigarette on the part of the manufacturers and their scientists is that you will not be able to stop smoking. You'll have to continue to replenish that craving. It'll adversely affect your body chemistry, your brain chemistry. You'll act no different than someone on opium, morphine, heroin, cocaine, or methamphetamine. Would then the public have consumed it in the same amounts? Maybe, maybe not. It's merely a hypothesis, but I believe in that freedom of information, which we have not had. In the diet sodas, you have all forms of artificial sweeteners, the most popular being aspartame. I have written extensively on aspartame. You can find articles up on GaryNoll.com that show you why aspartame is a poison and should never be consumed. It can increase stroke, it can increase brain tumors, it can increase metabolic syndrome, it can adversely affect your hormones, which in turn, guess what, can increase weight. So if they had started the story off differently and said, even a low or no calorie food or beverage can actually increase weight gain by adversely affecting your metabolism, in effect, chemically altering your metabolism, which is dangerous, that would have been a more appropriate way to have approached it, but they didn't. Sloppy journalism, incomplete journalism, rush journalism, whatever it is, you only got part of the story. Now you have more of it. I remember sitting every week in the office of Bob Guccione in his private townhouse over on 67th Street. It was at that time the largest private apartment in New York. I think it was about 45,000 square feet. That's a lot of living space. Six stories, beautiful building inside. I thought it looked like a mausoleum. He thought it was his home. So he had a mausoleum for his home. Nothing was comfortable. Everything was overdone. But it was, I remember one time going in, and I went to sit down. It was just at sunset, and he hadn't any lights on the room. And I saw him at a long table where he sat. And I went to sit on the couch. He said, oh, don't sit there. So I went to a chair. He said, oh, don't sit there. And I said, why? He said, look. So he turned on a light, and it was six Picassos. We're talking about original Picassos I just about sat on. I could just imagine the consequence of sitting on a Picasso and just boom. And I said, well, Bob, why do you have six original Picassos sitting on you? He said, I have no room to put them. So he walked around, and he had 186 the world's greatest artists throughout history. He had all of the great artists on his walls, and he had no more room. He didn't have them in the bathrooms. So until he found more space, he couldn't put them any place. At that time, it was the largest private master collection of any person, I guess, on the planet, maybe exception to the Queen of England. Anyhow, as we're sitting there, and I really liked Bob because he had an enormous amount of courage. He wasn't afraid to take on hard issues. Even when his own lawyers and staff and editors said, don't touch this topic, he would ask me a basic question. He said, what can we learn? How can the American public be helped if we take on this topic? Let's say, for instance, it was reporting on authentic, legitimate alternative therapies in cancer that were being repressed, like Dr. Brzezinski or Dr. Burton. And I explained that if we showed the politics behind it, and these people were legitimate, and there were patients who were alive and well who otherwise would end dead, and these are not quacks, and these are not people who are exploiting it, they are legitimate people, then we will save lives. And just like that, he'd say, how many lives you figure you would save? I said, well, based upon how many people could be treated in a given five-year period, I would say we'll save between 10 and 20,000 lives. He said, then we'll do it. And sitting across from him was this big, loudmouth lawyer named Roy Grubman. And Grubman was a gigantic of a fella. I'm going to guess he went about 6'4", weighed about 300 pounds. And he would bellow out, Bob, you're taking on the cancer establishment, they'll eat you for lunch. And Bob said, well, then I'm going to give him a really serious case of indigestion. And he said, Gary, go to work. So I would then go out and go to, you know, Mexico, Bahamas, Germany, wherever I had to go, interview thousands of people, dig into the muck of the whole politics of cancer, come back with a story, and that began the major series, the first of its kind in the United States, in a national magazine. And then he took posters out on billboards and buses and subways. It was on the news. There were debates. It was a big deal. I did 56 cover stories. And we got the word out. Brzezinski's practice was saved. He would have lost his license. Burton's practice was saved. They closed his clinic. We got it open. And today, a lot more people know that alternative therapies exist because of this one man, Bob Guccione. This was his passion, investigative reporting, real investigative journalism, where nothing was off limits. We didn't have to qualify anything with official sources. In fact, more often than not, the official sources were part of the problem, and we exposed that. Now, every single time I saw Bob, he was drinking a diet soda. He would drink 10 to 15 a day. And I said, Bob, you're where? And I gave him a report on NutraSweet. This is causing all forms of biochemical imbalances and problems. And he knew that it would cause a problem, but he didn't know what kind of problem or when. And as long as it didn't, he just kept doing it. And for 25 years, Bob and I had this relationship of me going out. I didn't have to talk with the editors or anyone in the company. I just go out and do a story that I felt was important, meet with Bob, we'd go over it, he'd approve it, and then I'd give it to him, and that was it. Then he got cancer. And he got throat cancer. He lost his whole company. Ended up living in a trailer. Interesting to see a man who had been on Forbes' wealthiest list living in a trailer. He had his flaws, but my God, he was courageous. I've never seen a publisher who had the courage to take on sacred cows the way he did. But he did. And I'm wondering now, would he still be alive, which I believe he would be, had he not drank those diet sodas? But he even knew they were dangerous, and he still did it anyhow. So just imagine the next time you go to eat anything with an artificial sweetener, what risk you're placing yourself at. Is it worth it? If you don't have the disease today, how do you know you won't get it next month, next year? The heart attack, the stroke, the blindness, the brain tumor. How do you know it's not going to happen? I don't believe that we should have a nation dealing in this kind of Russian roulette. This should be banned. This is a toxic substance. And this came through the company that completely perverted the FDA. And in fact, two U.S. attorneys were going after the company, cereal company, that made NutraSweet. And who was it? A man named Rumsfeld? Gee whiz, where do we remember the name Donald Rumsfeld? Could have been associated with weapons of mass destruction. Now, let's call that weapons of mass deception, Danny Schechter's term. Guess what happened to both U.S. attorneys? Wow, that's unusual. They ended up quitting and going to work for the law firm that represented Cyril NutraSweet. And that's how the game is played. Next up, survey ranks San Francisco greenest U.S. city. This is from Reuters. San Francisco is the greenest city in North America, followed by Vancouver. The survey commissioned by the Simmons Corporation, conducted by the Economics Intelligence Unit, looks at 31 indicators ranging from consumption of water and electricity and efficiency standards. Detroit was the least green of 27 cities ranked, just behind St. Louis. Well, that's true, but how in the world could they not factor in there that it sits on an earthquake fault? Gee, did they leave that out of there? Yeah, it's green, and then you're in the ocean. For those of you who don't want to use any kind of artificial sweetener, and historically you've been looking for better natural sweeteners, I'm suggesting coconut sugar to replace your agave and other even natural sweeteners. There's a lot of good science supporting coconut sugar. And the sweetener is popular, especially among those of us who are vegan. The coconut sugar should be 100% pure organic crystalline coconut sap. And it's harvested from the sap of unopened coconut blossoms. Then it's heated under controlled heat to drive off the water and condense the liquid to a dark brown sap. There are no additives, no bleaching, and absolutely no stripping of minerals. So it's mineral rich. It's not a raw food, but it's very good. And it has low glycemic element. And it kind of tastes like fudge. So you can try this. It's a much healthier natural sweetener. And last up, mobile phone-derived electromagnetic fields can disturb learning. This is from Ruhr University. Quote, from Germany, high-frequency non-ionizing radiation emitted by mobile phones, your cell phones, is redundantly matter of discussions. The effects of, quote, high-frequency electromagnetic fields derived from mobile phones have been in the sciences for a long time. Neuroscientists from the university are now able to elucidate issues that it will impact the synaptic level within the brain, independent from other factors like stress, and this in turn can influence learning. So what this means in lay language is that your cell phone is creating non-ionizing radiation, which produces high levels of heat, and that heat is destroying chromosomes or altering chromosomes, which in turn can interfere with your DNA. So my suggestion is that you not use a cell phone unless you have a protective guard. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. If you like the Allman Brother Band, a little bit of that southern guitar, banjo. Today's special, then we're going to a commentary on how greed destroys America. Later on, in about 20 minutes, my guest, Professor Jeff Madrick, on America's Age of Greed and how we got it there, and time permitting, vaccines as cluster bombs, what it does to our DNA. Exactly opposite what we've been told. You won't want to miss that. I'm not always able to get everything in a given show. What I don't get in, I'll get in the next day or so. Our special for today, we haven't had one in a couple weeks. In fact, I haven't had this in, I guess, over a year and a half. People ask for it, so I said, fine. So we're giving you today Friendly Fiber. If you don't know what friendly fiber is, as you know, all of us require fiber. But most people get the fiber just by having some psyllium. Okay, nothing wrong with that. But why not have the Rolls Royce of fiber? We know why we need fiber. I won't give you that background. Let me just read the ingredient list off friendly fiber. I want to raise the bar to get the best possible combination of all fibers. This had not been done before to my knowledge, and it's still considered by anyone who uses it the best fiber they've ever had. I start with the finest flaxseed, then I go to psyllium husk, rice bran, apple fiber, lecithin, oat bran, rice bran solubles, good bacteria, apple, grapefruit, orange, pineapple, lemon, lime, cherry, watermelon, pear, mango, strawberry, papaya, tangerine, apricot, and cranberries. guar gum, Jerusalem artichoke, vitamin C, ginger root, fennel seed, anise, and cinnamon. It's kosher. There's no sugar, starches, salt, honey, eggs. It's vegan. All that is excluded. All that is, I just told you, was included. So this is the best type of insoluble fibers, the best pectins, the best part of the fruits, the best of everything put into one single product. You take one scoop at night before you go to bed. And my suggestion, use this each night for 60 days. 60 on, 30 off. 60 on, 30 off. So it's terrific. And it's yours. Buy one and get one free. I won't tell you why you should be using this, but you should know. And you're getting a lot of fiber in here. In fact, it has one of the highest concentrations of fiber, 13 grams per serving. That's a whole lot. For a lot of people, that's more than what they would get for the rest of the whole day. So here's the deal. With my own exclusive creation of this friendly fiber, you buy one, you're going to get one free, plus I'm going to give you the DVD, Detoxification, A Natural Approach, with all the top experts on explaining why you should detoxify, how it should start with the intestine and colon, and why that's so important, how to do it safely and effectively, what isn't a good way to do it, step by step. Detoxification, A Natural Approach, is 2 hours long. It's $40. That's my gift. You're getting a $40 gift free today. You're getting a free bottle at $35 of friendly fiber when you call and get one. So that's a phenomenal deal. You're getting $75 free in product for ordering one $34.95 jar. All that goes to the Progressive Radio Network. That's why no one else has to ever pitch, just me once in a while. Call 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 for your friendly fiber. Everybody can benefit from this in this audience. Everybody needs fiber. Everybody needs to keep that in colon and intestine, ascending, descending, transverse intestine. Everybody should have a healthy, properly functioning peristalsis. I wonder how many people know what's in your intestine. I don't think you'd like to look in there. You sure wouldn't like to smell in there. Whoa, it's bad. So this is one way of helping to turn this around. Let's get ourselves healthy. Let's get ourselves clean. Let's get ourselves normalized. Let's get ourselves moving, flowing as we should. Friendly fiber, plus you get all that other stuff for free today when you call 877-627-5065. Now, a couple of program announcements. This weekend, I will be meeting with people who want to do a homesteading project. It's going to take about 3 months or longer from the time a person is approved with a project they do before I can bring them on board and that they show that they have mastered what they're doing and that it's something that they like doing and can be sustainable. And that's it. It's only for people this time around. Last week I did a whole discussion for anyone who wants to do their own. This is only working on an upcoming project that I'm doing because I'm going to be inviting some people down to the homestead in what will ultimately be the most comprehensive, integrated, holistic eco-village sustainable project ever. And it is moving forward. So now it's a matter of talking with people who are able to do a homesteading project that would fit in. To qualify for this, you're going to have to speak with Luann, but I don't have Luann's phone number right now, so I'll give you Jason's phone number in a second, and then you can call Jason. And I'll be talking with people this Sunday at 1 o'clock in my studio in New York City, and then over the phone at the same time. You'll have to call to make a reservation, because last week we were packed, the week before that we were packed, and this will be the last time we'll be doing this. Now let's go to our commentary, and then some thoughts from you. This is about greed. My guest in a little while will be talking about greed. How many times, by the way, have you heard people speak about let the market dictate our reality. I mean, you hear it all the time. You hear it on Sean Hannity. They say, look, we don't want the government telling us what to do, how to run your business, and then overtaxing you and overburdening you so that even well-intentioned people trying to do the good things with their life and helping other people, they can't. They're hamstrung. By the way, that part of it I agree with. I don't disagree with that. I'm a big believer in supporting the small business person who, working within their local community, hiring people at a good living wage and working to support that local community and making things, producing things, and offering services in their local community. That's what we're missing in America today. I don't think there's any question about that. But it's the fact that they don't want to look at the larger reality, that a lot of this, their ideas are based on pure unmitigated greed. So if the free market theories of Ayn Rand and Milton Friedman, the former professor up at the University of Chicago, were correct, the United States during the last 30 years should have experienced a golden age in which the lavish rewards flowing to the leaders of industry would have transformed our society into a vibrant force for beneficial progress. After all, it has been the faith of free market economics as a kind of secular religion that has driven U.S. government policies from the emergence of Ronald Reagan through the neoliberalism of Bill Clinton into the brave new world of House Republican Budget Chairman Paul Ryan. And Obama supports all that. By slashing income tax rates to historical levels and only slightly boosting them under President Clinton before dropping them again under George Bush, the U.S. government essentially incentivized greed by what Ayn Rand liked to call the virtue of selfishness. Well, further, by encouraging global free trade and removing regulations like the New Deal's Glass-Steagall separation of commercial banks and investment banks, the government also got out of the way of progress by letting the progress mean crush the public, crush the middle class, exploit them, and make all the money for yourself. True, not all the extreme concepts of Ayn Rand and economist Milton Friedman have been implemented. There are still programs like Social Security and Medicare to get rid of by their so-called magic of the market, but that is being done now. We should also be able to assess whether laissez-faire capitalism is superior to the mixed public-private economy that dominated much of the 20th century. Now, when I was growing up as a baby boomer, we had good public education. Now, I went to school. You were supposed to just study. If you didn't know what you were studying or couldn't learn the class, you were held over, not embarrassed, but you were held over and you had to take night school. The teacher would actually stay in the evening and work with you. I remember Miss Hendricks used to do this with kids all the time. And then if you still didn't get it, you would go to summer school. Or you'd be held back. You know, they didn't want to promote you forward if you didn't know what you were doing because you would only end up failing forward. They didn't want you to fail forward, like No Child Left Behind, the idiotic, absolutely mind-numbingly stupid program of George Bush. Oh, gee whiz, did we forget a mind-stupid person who just didn't understand education to begin with. But we didn't have that when I was growing up. And if you got sick, you went to a public hospital. In my town, it was St. Joseph Hospital, Canon Clark Hospital, and you got treated. You didn't go broke because you couldn't pay the bill. And oh yeah, there was a GI loan of 2%. My dad built a little 1,100 square foot house that our whole family lived in and on Covert Street, and we loved it. I loved it. I didn't know that being middle class was a bad thing. It was a good thing. I never got up any morning and felt bad because of what I didn't have. I got up and went out and played every day with my friends, all who were as equally middle class as I was. And I thought everything was pretty good. And then I began to see the rest of the world after high school and after college and Seoul, Vietnam, and the politics we were living through. And I wrote about it, and I demonstrated against it. I was a social activist. And then I saw something unique happening in the 1970s, and I began to talk about it, but all the people who had been with me during, you know, our more in the streets protesting, they had gone back into society. They no longer were joining us in the streets. And I saw people taking over companies, loading them with debt, stripping off the employees, moving the company overseas. In my hometown, it was a brick factory. and that had been there for over 100 years. And people would live there and work there and expected when they retired, they'd have a pension and they'd be able to live thereafter in modest means. Well, that was all gone because they stripped off, when they bought the company, they stripped off the people's pensions. They literally stole their pensions. And all through these unique new strategies of junk bonds and leverage buyouts. Well, this was been going on all across the United States. So in 1990, I decided to do a survey and found that there were thousands and thousands of companies that had been bought and their employees outsourced to other countries. So I began to talk with people I knew on Wall Street and said, this isn't the part of the American dream that I grew up with as a kid, nor you. And the answer was, yeah, but look, Gary, historically we had to wait to the end of the year to see whether or not the company, whether it was a steel mill or IBM or Xerox or a furniture factory, or whether or not it made enough profit to give us back a return. Returns were very small, 1-2% return on our money. Now, Gary, we can go in and borrow money, buy a company, load it up with debt, sometimes twice the price we bought it for. We can buy a company for $10 million, borrow $20 million, keep the $10 for ourselves as pure profit. The company has to pay the $20 million back. If it can't, we strip off the employee, sell off its profitable divisions, and we've made our money. We're debt-free, and we're whole. Now, yeah, the local community might lose, 400 jobs. So what? I said, so what? Those are human beings. Well, we don't look at them as human beings from Wall Street. They're income streams. That's the only value they have. So I remember asking a person, I said, so you only look at people in America as a commodity. He said, everyone on Wall Street only sees people as commodities. They may not say that and will not say that to the public because it'll give a bad impression of them. But that's what all of us do every day. We commodify, commercialize, exploit, take our profits, and we don't look at the moral consequences of our choices. Okay. So that is what we have been led to deal with. So when you look back over the last 35 years, prior to this economic, double recession, we have been doing this, offshoring jobs, for no other reason than people can make astronomical profits immediately. We have seen this in plain sight. We chose not to pay attention to it. We chose not to protest it. We chose not to demonstrate. We chose not to write editorials about it. We chose not to make it a public issue. It didn't come up in any of the major campaigns, only briefly through NAFTA. But the Republicans were bought as well as the Democrats bought by President Clinton, so everyone was on board. Even the pro-union Democrats went on board. Few rebelled against it. Now look back at the consequences of Clinton and the others, NAFTA, GATT, World Trade Organization. Millions of jobs lost, but they had reassimilated back in, but no longer at a $28 hour salary. Now they're flipping hamburgers at McDonald's. Oh, but they're gainfully employed. No, they're not. That's the consequence of greed. And I believe that is how greed has destroyed America. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear yours. Give us a call. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. By the way, Jason's number, if you're interested in the coming in on the homesteading project, you can call the number 646-926-5428. 646-926-5428. And listen to this about some people speaking out. You could agree or disagree, but this is what we don't hear on any of the networks or cable shows. We are not given this kind of concentrated, passionate energy challenging those in power to deal honestly with any issue as if we were capable of it.
We've heard a lot of talk about change this year. The question is, change to what? To me, change is a government that doesn't let banks and oil companies rip off the American people.
People say things when they're running because they don't know the powers that really control the House that they're going to live in.
White folks I work with ain't so bad.
That's why I say America needs a regime change, or the American people will never have what the Constitution guarantees.
Is that what you're worried about?
You think Barack Obama can do that?
No.
Bull.
Absolutely not.
So what are you saying?
I'm saying that no matter who sits in the White House, if you don't uproot the structure that corrupts them, you still don't have a president. You have a figurehead. So when you look at Bush, you think you're looking at the president. There's another power behind him. When you look at Blair, you think you're looking at the prime minister. But there's another power behind these people. And the powers that are dogging the whole world are the international bankers that finance both sides of a conflict.
You see, the real value of a conflict, the true value, is in the debt that it creates. You control the debt, you control everything. This is the very essence of the banking industry. Their objective isn't to control the conflict. This is not about making profit from weapons sales. It's to control the debt that the conflict produces. To make us all slaves to debt.
So the people that bankroll you, they're the ones that ultimately call the tune.
You find this upsetting, yes?
How far up your does this guy's have to be before you realize he's f***ing you?
What is the proper relationship, what should be the proper relationship between the chairman of the Fed and a president of the United States?
What the relationships are, don't frankly matter.
Hold on a minute, something's slapping my ass. Hey, he's
f***ing
us!
There is no other agency of government which can overrule actions that we take.
And I said, I don't think the members of Congress really know how little effect they have in controlling things. Really, this, and that means that the Congress itself doesn't have much control. The people doesn't have much to say. They don't have much to say about it either. The control of overall policy is really in the hands of a very small number of people who control all the administrations, all the appointments to cabinets, and certainly all the appointments to the Federal Reserve.
And so my first question is, yes or no, do you support the concept of having the presidents of each of the Federal Reserve banks join the ranks of your Board of Governors and be nominated by the President and confirmed by the Senate to have a more representative Fed?
No.
Wait a minute. Something's slapping my
Who elected Ben Bernanke and who elected Alan Greenspan?
Thank you for saying that.
America, and nobody elected them.
I was just going to say, did anybody notice they're not talking about who was in that room representing you, America?
Now I want you to walk with me. I got lawyers up here, lawyers down there, politicians up here, politicians down there. Let's walk through this criminal enterprise. Walk through it. Walk through it. I gotta say, you're dealing with a criminal government here. These are criminals in power. Because I really don't care no more about what anybody thinks. If you don't have the testicular fortitude to say what needs to be said, then sit down and stop trying to say you speak for our people and the hurt of the poor. Now I close. Excuse me.
I think I'm getting excited.
Now, I may sound radical to you. I may sound like I've gone off a little, but I want to prove what I just said. See, these are criminals. Maybe not in your eyes, but you can't see. Right now, you see your government as a tree, immovable, strong and powerful like a tree. You don't see, as you should see, the mannequins in the window of the Democratic store. They're dressed beautifully,
They want you to try on democracy. This country don't give a damn about democracy. They're tricking you. This thing called democracy is a trick. Even right now, register to vote. Who the hell you gonna vote for? Who are you voting for? Well, thank God. We can get rid of Bush. You a fool. You mean you got hope in this corrupt political system? Do you really think that this corrupt political system...
And those are thoughts that we do not hear. Can we take the time to examine the objectivity or lack of objectivity in the anger that's spewing forth from synagogues and mosques and churches and town hall meetings and union places? I'm Gary Knoll. I don't condone or nor condemn people for their thoughts, but what I see in the halls of Congress, what I see in the media, and as an exclusion of those individuals who have a voice that would challenge those in power. And I believe it's time that we allow those voices an opportunity to be heard. You either find support or not in them, agree or not with them. But as he said, you believe we have a democracy, then a democracy means that a person of any means, financially, a school teacher, a social worker, a police officer, could run for any office and have some chance of being elected. How real is that today when the mayor of New York spends $105 million to become the mayor of New York? Or governor of California Christy Whitman spent over $135 million for a billion-dollar fortune but didn't get elected. And now we're saying that we have to spend $100 billion minimum this year for one candidate to get him elected. Where did democracy go? Where does the Citizens United go when it allows corporations to influence elections by buying politicians or buying access to politicians or having access to legislation? The destruction of rules put in place like the Glass-Steagall Act that protects us. Where are these being discussed in an open, honest, democratic forum? Or is that considered too radical? Do we exclude a person because we don't like the tone of their voice, we don't like their message, and say you're an impolite politic and we will not hear you now, there is no room at the table for you, you're impertinent, you're obstreperous, you're contentious, and the person says, I'm simply being honest. Isn't there room for honesty? Your thoughts. My guest is now on board. Let's go over and say hello to my guest, Professor Jeff Madrick. Adjunct professor, Cooper Union, and a senior fellow at the Roosevelt Institute and the Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysts at the New School. He is a regular columnist for the New York Review of Books and a former economics columnist for the New York Times. He's written many books, his latest, The Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the present. Nice to have you with us today.
Well, it's nice to be with you. Thank you.
Would you please give us your overview of how did we get from where we did have a large, vibrant, growing, working, and middle class to where over 100 million Americans are now struggling with their bills? Much of what they had owned is now lost or at threat of being lost, and there's so little being done to focus on their needs, and yet so much is being done to focus on the needs of those who seem to be even becoming wealthier and more powerful.
Well, Gary, I think it began in the 1970s, and that's the ground my new book, Age of Greed, covers. It leads up to, as a climax, the recent crisis and this very severe recession. But we've been, the financial community has been misallocating resources for 40 years now, not just a few years, and that seriously harmed America's prospects for prosperity. But it also, what began in the 1970s, was the adoption of an attitude, to some degree some reform is necessary, but the adoption of an attitude that holding inflation down is all that mattered, that the Federal Reserve Bank held all the policy cards in this respect, that keeping wages down was important, or keeping wages from rising very much was important, because that allowed you to hold inflation down. And that was part of a broad and deep ideological shift in the 1970s that only got worse and led to deregulation and the lack of enforcement of common sense regulations and oversight of a financial community that ran amok, and a central single policy, which was keep inflation down at all costs. And by and large, the hide was taken out of labor. I don't only mean organized labor, I mean working people, and that means you and me.
I appreciate that oversight. We just heard Alan Greenspan say that no governmental agency can override the Federal Reserve's policies. We also heard Ben Bernanke say, by a member of Congress, why can't we have the individual governors interviewed in depth from the different Federal Reserve banks? And we were told, no, that's not going to happen. So that the Fed can continue working on economic policies and without any real input from outside economists who may have more progressive views and challenge them, or even from members of Congress. How can we allow this unimpeded access to power to go unchallenged?
Well, you know, the origins of the Fed were an attempt to keep the currency sound. The job expanded over the years. It expanded to keep the economy sound. And in expanding, I think you've got a point. We need more. The Fed stands alone almost dictatorially as the arbiter of what our monetary policy can be. And in the last 30 years, monetary policy was about the only policy tool the federal government had. So I think there has to be more scrutiny of the Fed, and I think that's totally justified. The Fed also was the key regulator of the banks. And here, under Alan Greenspan, who turned out to be the ideologue that many of us knew he was under the skin but had hoped maybe he would suppress to some degree, turned out to be the ideologue who believed in laissez-faire at almost any cost. The cost, of course, has been what we've seen recently. He had the power to act. He had the power to investigate. He had the power to send bank examiners out. He had the power to stop mortgage fraud. There were other agencies that it could have and should have done a far better job as well, not least the Securities and Exchange Commission. So we have a serious abdication of government responsibility. But it did begin, as I say, in the 1970s, and I try to tell the story of that through individuals in this book, because it is a history. It's not, it's actually, I think, a pretty interesting tale.
I appreciate that. Let me share a thought with you and see if this in any way resonates with your own research. During the 1970s and 80s, I began to see a pattern of companies then called leveraged buyouts, before that Greenmailers, Saul Steinberg, T. Boone Pickens, Ivan Botsky, Michael Milken, and Carl Icahn, the leaders but not the exclusive ones, using junk bond. They found a way that using debt and leverage, they could buy very profitable companies, load that company up with debt, take enormous bonuses off the top end of that, work with Wall Street firms with bridge loans, and lo and behold, a person that went to work expecting to go back to work every day for the rest of their lives now was frequently being downsized or laid off, and that company closed completely. That happened in my hometown with a brick factory. It had been there for over 100 years. Now, suddenly, everything's being outported to another country, not the least of which was India, China, even Bangladesh or Haiti. And yet, all the while this was happening, America paid more attention to what these people could buy with the money, their yachts, their houses, the salaries. Michael Milken, the first person to ever make $1 billion in 1 year at Drexel, and in bonuses. And yet, no one looked at the morality of should we be using debt in such a way that it was so disadvantageous to the local community and its sustainability. Now, I looked by 2003. I did as much as I could during a six-month period to see how many Americans approximately had been downsized or laid off or their jobs cut, and it was over 22 million up till 2003, I couldn't find any single article that would report that it was bits and pieces brought together, and yet no one seemed to notice that long before this offshoring, we had massive offshoring, but no one thought it was an issue. Now we're paying attention. Did you experience anything in your research like that, that this wasn't happening, just we didn't suddenly have a heart attack or a stroke, that this had been clogging the arteries for a long time before we tipped?
Well, that's the heart of what my book is about. You know, free market economies, and I do believe that free market economies have enormous strengths. They have to be balanced, however, really balanced, with government oversight, government investment in areas they don't invest in, and so forth. But the book is about how this has been happening all along. There are people who believed, and, you know, to some degree, capitalist free market economies do have to be pruned out of old companies, old-fashioned companies, poorly managed companies. But what happened, and the reason I call this book Age of Greed, is that the financial community was allowed to make an enormous amount of money by encouraging takeovers, LBOs, leverage buyouts, as you call them, based on debt, because these powerful men could have access to banks and Mike Milken's junk bond market, create a takeover mentality, which is unless you get your stock price up, you're going to be taken over. And even if you are taken over, the consequences will be the same. You will cut labor costs and you'll probably cut R&D. Now, some takeovers worked, but for the most part, the evidence is very good. And this is not extreme evidence by any means. Very good that most of these takeovers failed, and Wall Street and investors paid way too high a price to take over these companies. Why? The answer is simple. People became billionaires as a consequence, or multi-centered heirs, as we call them, 100 millionaires, as a consequence of that. And that was one example of a lot that went on in the last 40 years. But it led to a climate where it was increasingly okay to cut jobs, offshore jobs, and even cut R&D, and take far less risk in new, productive, healthy, prosperity-making business ideas than we once did, because these people could make so much money simply by cutting labor and cutting R&D and getting that stock price up. The CEOs of these ventures started to work for Wall Street. Used to be Wall Street worked for CEOs in America. But once they were given all these stock options, and once the takeover game began, and other games began that included derivatives and IPO, initial public offerings of these high technology fantasy companies, the CEOs started really working for Wall Street, and the nature of the way American business was changed. So this is not a new process, and centrally, I think you are correct in your analysis.
Two questions I'd like for you to address, if you would, please, and they are concomitant. One is that if we accept what Alan Greenspan and his mentor, philosophically, Ayn Rand, and Milton Friedman, that let the market dictate and keep the government off our backs. If we profit, we deserve it. If we don't, we should go out of business. All right, that's their philosophy. Interesting, Ayn Rand later in her life ended up secretly getting Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah.
There's a kind of little hypocrisy there. But why is it that we have then consistently given subsidies to major corporations? The oil industry gets over $100 billion. The military-industrial complex gets over $400 billion. And the banking industry and all these different groups get subsidies where they can privatize the profits, socialize their losses or their needs. And they don't see a contradiction in that. And then when they do fail, instead of doing what they claim they should be able to do, downsize, go through constructive bankruptcies and reorganize a poorly run company and let the market take over that and build a better company, they immediately boost up companies that are poorly run to begin with and then make them too big to fail. And then we at the second part of that is the Federal Reserve gave $3.3 trillion, according to Barney Frank's getting the information out. Barney Sanders of Vermont getting it from Freedom of Information Act, $3.3 $1 trillion in 22,000 transactions, none of which went to the American public or small businesses, but all went to the hedge funds, equity partnerships, banks in America, banks elsewhere. And we found this out at 0.25% interest. Much of that then came back and to so-called support the American Treasury, and they got anywhere from 2.2 to 3.1% on even going into China and Brazil, getting up to 6 to 8% interest on money that cost them nothing. And all the while, the American public is getting dumped on, and all the while, they're screaming, we don't want the government on our back, we believe in free market. And I'm saying, my God, I'm hearing nothing but contradictions between what you say and what you do. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I'd love to be able to argue with you on that, but I really can't, Steve. I think that by and large summarizes what's occurred. Now, let me be clear. Once we got into this mess, this in 2008, this mess was so bad that I do believe the government had to bail these banks out. I do believe, in fact, that TARP came along and stabilized the economy momentarily, the world financial system, for a few weeks, or things would have gotten terrifyingly worse. However, these policies could have been constructed in a way that forced the banks, required the banks to lend out this money, to start adjusting these mortgages and these foreclosures in a way to solve the mortgage crisis, to lend out the money to small business and medium-sized business and even big business. Instead, the bailout was created to allow these banks to regain their profitability. Again, in the background is this simplistic notion about free market capitalism. If they get profitable again, they will start doing what they should be doing, which is lending out money to business. But they really have not been doing that in many respects for a very long time. They've been shuffling paper and playing derivatives games, all kinds of things, because their bankers could make $5, $10, $15, $100 million in bonuses a year and take little risk of ever, even when they lose money, of having to pay any of it back. So I essentially agree. We're a long way from coming to grips with this. I do not think the Obama administration has been nearly tough enough on these banks. You know, the derivatives were all traded secretly, or almost all of them traded secretly. And that violates every conservative, laissez-faire economic principle. And no one stood up to change that, not Larry Summers, not Alan Greenspan, certainly not the conservative economists who were the ones who should have been most vociferous about it, actually. No one stood up on these issues. We've lived in a fairly outrageous time, and while I think it started in an ideological shift in the 1970s, it's been compounded by what we all talk about all the time now, and you've talked about before, the cost of elections, the power of rich people to influence politicians, the lobbying efforts. Just one example, on those derivatives and the Dodd-Frank bill, there are 50 rules that have to be written. That's a lot of rules. But the SEC got 20 and the CFTC got 20,000 comments, which they are required to go through. And what's Congress doing? Cutting the budgets of the SEC and CFTC, basically the House Republicans. And some of them are saying, we don't need regulations. We really live, this must be another world because it can't be the real world.
We don't need regulations, my goodness.
I think Mitch McConnell, I may have the wrong congressman, well, but I think he said it the other
And
day.
Even today, even as we speak, and Greece is getting another additional funding from the European Central Bank and the International Monetary Fund to refinance them just for another 3 months. One of the big hidden players in this are some $80 billion in derivatives bets out there, and yet none of that is regulated. I really appreciate the good work you've done on this. Hopefully people will take the chance to read this, and what an education it is. Age of Greed, The Triumph of Finance and the Decline of America, 1970 to the Present, by my guest, Professor Jeff Madrick. Thank you very much for being
Enjoyed
with us
it.
Today.
Thank you.
And very important. And, of course, behind all this is another reality. And that other reality is that no one is helping the American public. No one. So the banks are helped. The major businesses are helped. They're sitting on $2 trillion. The Federal Reserve has unlimited amounts of money to give them. And yet, ask a bank, friend, could you help me with my mortgage? I can't afford it. Could you lower the interest rate for me, maybe from 8% to 6 or 6 to 4, so I could stay in my house? And the bank, no. No, we're going to take your house back and we're going to resell it. And then we're going to write off, we're going to double dip. We're going to do something that no one's going to look at, but we're going to write 100% of the cost of your house to us off so we don't pay tax on it. Then we're going to resell it into the marketplace and probably buy it back for 10 cents on the dollar and then resell it again. And this is what's happening to us. Both Democrat and Republicans are supporting this. Joining me in studio is Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. This is really about the media here. Today in the UK, we're seeing a general strike by the public sector over pensions. And in Greece, as you mentioned, they're rioting over the passing of the new austerity measures. And the USA, the US media are projecting that this is a bad thing. Let's hope it doesn't happen in America. But in your opinion, what does this mean? Why is it that we don't want these things to happen over here? And what does that tell us about us?
Well, first, if you heard some of the comments, there was Glenn Beck, there was there were different people making comments in Farrakhan and others in that comment. Now, that doesn't mean you support or reject them. It just means we don't have people publicly saying to our government, you're engaged in criminal activity. The war in Iraq, criminal activity. The war in Afghanistan, the war in Pakistan. The fact that you've killed 134,000 civilians directly in Iraq. Well, okay, but we originally went in because we were lied to. And then we were told that we had to be there because Saddam Hussein was a bad person. We had proof that he'd killed over 11,000 of his own citizens. Probably did, maybe more. Well, we've killed 10 times that amount of his citizens. It's the Janet Reno phenomena of Waco. In order to save the children at Branch Davidian, you have to kill them all by burning them to death. That's that kind of mindset. To save the people of Iraq, we first have to kill them. We have to make, you know, over 5 million of them refugees. We have to kill 500,000 of their children from bad water. We have to permanently and forever destroy their environment with depleted uranium. We have to destroy their infrastructures. We have to allow ethnic cleansing by arming the Shia against the Sunni. The Sunni had been in power at 20% in the Ba'athist Party. The Shia were not in power. Now the power party killed the other. So ethnic neighborhoods that have both in the same neighborhood, a Shia and Sunni living together, all that's gone. Gigantic concrete walls separate out the city. It's like a prison maze in there. But we brought what? Democracy? No. We've lost $3.7 trillion between these two conflicts. $3.7 trillion could have made every infrastructure that's faulty in the United States whole again. We could have had universal health care. We could have gotten ahead of all technologies to make them green. We could have made America competitive again. We could have brought manufacturing back. We could have de-ghettoized all the cities. All that we could have done, we did none of that. We gave it all to corrupt contractors. We gave it to the people there. Now, we don't have anyone willing to go before the American public on the media and say these things with any passion. A, if you're passionate, oh, we can't trust you. You got angry. Oh, so we can't have anyone? No, you can't be angry. You got to be non-angry. Oh, you can't be an advocate. Can't be an advocate, I see. So we don't have advocates and we don't have people who are angry. What about telling the truth? Oh, no, you can't be telling the truth unless it's official truth. Official truth like the New York Times you're allowed to tell. But unlike the New York Times, you can never tell truth outside of official sources because then who are you going to verify it with? I see. So if I have a truth but I can't verify it with an official agency, then it's no longer the truth and I can't handle it. So I can't tell you about the vaccines not being safe or effective. I can't tell you about artificial sweeteners killing us and the politics getting it on. I can't tell you about any of that. Yeah, that's the truth. Now you got the truth.
Yeah.
And that's how we live.
Right.
Okay. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for taking your time to listen. And I want everyone to have a wonderful day. I'm broadcasting live from our studio in New York City. But now, one final let me just add this. The reason that American media left and right are concerned about what's going on in the streets of Greece or the hundreds of thousands protesting today in England, peacefully, no arrests in England, is because the people in England, at the end of the day, for their retirement, their pension will get about $96. $96. Ever try to live on $96 a month? Huh? So, not a big pension. And the people in Greece, 20% of their paychecks are going to be cut back and their pensions cut back. And a lot of people, public services are going to be taken away. Why? Because the rich never paid taxes. The corporations never paid taxes. The government was corrupt. The government put money into submarines. Gee, let's see. Does Greece need submarines? I don't think so, unless they're looking for Atlantis again. And they worked to cover all this up with Goldman Sachs, who got $400 million. So let's give Goldman Sachs $400 million. Let's lie to our people. Let's let people think we're solvent when we're insolvent. And all this. Now, the people in Greece are protesting the only way they have. They can go to the streets. They can try to let the government know we're not going to take it anymore. We're sick and tired, not going to take it anymore. That scares us because we don't do that in America. And if we do it, then we try to make the people look like they're terrorists. They're destabilizing society. We can't have this. You can't do this in America. Because left and right, it scares us. Only some aging hippie or some young anarchist would ever go to the street and actually risk arrest and risk authority. No, we got to stand behind law and order. Which law and order are you referring to? The law and order allows the government to eavesdrop illegally, it allows you to eviscerate the Constitution, allows you to take away habeas corpus, allows you to violate all of our rights. Is that the law and order you want? Two sets of laws, one for the rich and famous. You can kill people and get away with it. Vioxx, 60,000 dead, and no one went to jail, no one's reputation was harmed. That's the law and order you want? What about if 100,000 doctors went in front of the FDA and says, we're sick and tired of this giving us drugs that kill our patients, and yet we're rewarded, the patient dies, and nobody's held accountable? Shame on you, FDA. Shame on you, President of the United States. Shame on the lobbyists. Shame on the drug makers. Shame on the insurance companies. Shame on the hospitals. Shame on the nurses. Shame on everyone that allowed that patient to die when we all knew what the chances of them living or dying was with medicines that don't work. 80% of American medicine doesn't work. But we're not going to reform it. We're not going to change it. We're not going to criticize it. We're not going to acknowledge it because officially there's no problem. And as long as it's official, the New York Times will say there's no problem. So what are you going to do? Protest something where there's no problem? In England, they're protesting. In Ireland, they're protesting. They're raising hell. In the United States, unless we're officially acknowledged by our Tea Party people or our Libertarian people or our Constitutional people or our Democrats or Republicans to go to the street and only for a specific cause, you will not see us in the streets. Yeah, you bet we're terrorized because we don't want 100 million Americans rising up as the young people did in the Middle East in 22 nations or the 19 nations rising up now that we're seeing in Portugal, in Spain, in Ireland, in France, in Italy. We don't want that because our entire edifice, our entire facade would crumble. It would vaporize because the illusion of our strength and tensile strength democracy would be shown to be nothing more than a candy cotton dream. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Jason Taubenfeld.